From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue our special election coverage with a conversation with political scientist and Du Boisian scholar, Professor Anthony Montero. Wow. So much going on. Pick it up where you'd like, and we'll go from there.
Well, there are three big things right now. I think, 5 days out from the election, I think they are what is reported in the New York Times this morning that the that 8 in 10 Americans do not see this election as resolving anything but worsening conditions in the country and further dividing the country, and that large numbers of Republicans suggest that the Republican Party is irreparably divided, which means that it will not be brought back together after the election, even if Trump wins. And large numbers of Democrats feel the same way, which I read to suggest not only a rejection of the parties, but that they will split and the duopoly may be on its last legs. But bigger than that is that the political system itself is seen as broken and incapable of leading officials or leaders that can lead the country. The country will be leaderless and rudderless for the foreseeable future. And as we have said, you know, you and I, Don, have said this over the months, that the country is entering a period of ungovernability and political chaos.
Yeah, I mean, you pointed that out, Christ, it's almost a year ago now, and sure enough, that's almost everyone in the country now saying that.
Yeah. They, you know, but people don't use the term ungovernability. And you know, again, as we have discussed, you and I, this literal collapse of the left, first in the face of the Trump presidency, and now with this running to the hills, running to safety or security, you know, like bond traders and money managers getting out of the market because of their fear of what's coming. Well, you get the left and so-called progressive forces running to the so-called safety of Hillary, which is a huge illusion, as so many people are now pointing out. That's the least safe place in a generally unsafe environment.
You know, you talk about, first of all, the crisis of legitimacy and the apparent ungovernability that we're facing, and you know, almost the entire conversation has finally arrived at that point. You know, I guess you're ahead of your time, and but also the you know, at the head end of all of this, what you're looking at a situation where a reconfiguration of the body politic is underway. That the divisions between Republican voters and Democratic voters may remain, but there'll be different membership in each of those categories and organized around different issues, different enabling almost ideological positions, certainly political positions. The anti-war position, for example, and the anti-trade deal and pro-worker position, looking at only Trump and Clinton, is clearly on Trump's side, which means the Republican Party, which is a flip on its head, if not from facts, certainly from the commonly held belief.
Well, you know, the Trump Republican Party or the Trump campaign is an unsustainable coalition. You know, because Bernie Sanders refused to join the Trump insurgency, and that was a big refusal and a great strategic mistake. Because he refused to do that, it appears to me that Trump had to go against his better judgment, which is to be more liberal on social issues and kind of hunker down to get whatever remained of the kind of nativist grassroots, almost white supremacist Republicans to join him. So he would have some measure of movement on the ground from that part.
Right.
At the same time, he ran as an anti-trade, that is anti-neoliberal globalization, anti-NAFTA, anti-TPP, and anti-war candidate, which brought not only the Republican part of the working class more passionately into his fold, but also huge numbers of Democratic working class white voters.
Right.
Now, this meant, at the end of the day, he got the largest number of primary votes, over 13 million, that any Republican had ever gotten in the time that those kind of numbers are kept.
Right.
Then, as he enters the general election, he pivots towards black people, towards Haitians, towards Latinos, and that Latino label is a big thing. They're the conservative and reactionary Miami and Florida, South Florida Cubans, but they're also the Central Floridian Puerto Ricans and the Mexicans and Central Americans in the West. So he tries to bring them in. He tries to make overtures to the black community. Now, it is quite interesting, and we'll see this on Tuesday, how successful he was. The black vote is going to be extremely interesting and, again, strategic in the whole election. And no one actually knows what black folks are going to do, how they're going to split. And they have four options on the table, all of which black people are considering taking on Tuesday. The millennials will either, black millennials will either not vote or vote for a third party, possibly Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka. There is also the option among a broader swath of black people, especially the working class and poor, not to vote at all, because they do not feel that their issues, their situation, have been adequately addressed, and they have not been, and their conditions have not gotten better since the Great Recession of 2008. Then you get, of those who vote, and what we have to be aware of, that the percentage of black eligible voters that turn out will probably drop from a high of about 68% in 2012 down to the low 60s, probably 62% in 2016, which means then a 7% drop in the numbers that even vote. Now, this is huge for Hillary Clinton, who is trying to reconstruct the Obama coalition of 2012-28. The other thing, and this is the unknown and the huge question mark, how many will vote for Trump? This is unknown. Now, I would suggest that there is a certain sentiment in the black community, especially among the poor and working class, that is pro-Trump. Will they come out to vote? And if they do, will they actually vote for Trump? We'll see. It could go as high as 15%, which is as high as any Republican has gotten of the black vote in the past 30 years. This would be huge. Now, so the black vote is very, very important. I don't want to diminish the significance of what is called the Latino vote, but it is variegated. It is not one group. It's many groups. I think the most, the highest percentage of Latinos who will vote are the South Florida Cubans. They will vote in high percentages, and they will probably split between Hillary and Trump. In the West and Southwest, the Chicano, Mexican, American, and Central American vote will probably end up being something 70-30. Trump will get 30% of the Latino vote in Texas, New Mexico, and other states of the Southwest. Now, but it's only a coalition, this Trump coalition, that will go as far as Election Day. After the election, the question is, what will the Trump coalition look like? It will clearly not be made up of any of the elites of the Republican Party. Yeah. They will be more anti-Trump after the election than they are right now, and they're very anti-Trump.
If that's possible.
I think Trump will be left with his white, working-class, white, poor base. And I think they will become more active, more politically directed, and this is the key thing, more self-organized. In other words, the pattern of the Tea Party or the evangelicals will not apply, that kind of top-down organization. Right. I think they will become more self-organized, be more democratic. I think they will learn political lessons. And I think, interestingly, Trump's outreach in the way that he did it to the black community, especially the poor and urban working class, has primed them to begin to think about a black, white, Latino coalition from below.
You know, on that point, and leading, by the way, if you see after the election a coalescing of, say, millennials with the white working class, some of the lessons of Occupy Wall Street will come in terms of forms of democratic organizing, and also that, you know, brand new concept since the 30s in the United States of class in the American political consciousness and lexicon, the 1%. You know, the lost opportunity here, I wish I saw it back then and was, you know, screaming from the rooftop about it. The real lost opportunity was when Sanders saw that the election had been stolen from him, that he did not grab Trump and say, look, I'm bringing my people to you. I'm going to tell you, drop the Islamophobia, renounce it, drop the anti-immigrant tone to your thing about walls and all that stuff. Embrace the black and brown communities and the program that people have. Open up your coalition to us. We're coming in with these demands, and we want you to join those demands, and we'll join yours. And start building working class unity and say, and then when we get there, we're inviting in the people in the streets, Black Lives Matter, and everyone else that's out there. If they had done that, the polls would be something like 70% to 30, and you'd have this movement coalescing already with multiple, heads, I guess.
That would have been the optimal. And we talked about this possibility, and this is, had the Democratic establishment not stolen the election from Bernie Sanders, a general election with Trump and Bernie Sanders. That would have been the optimal in terms of a general election.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, there's a clash. between the populism, grassroots populism of Trump and the social democracy, which is pretty much liberalism of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And this is what we now know. He, as a person, was prepared to go but so far.
Right.
Trump is prepared to go further in attacking the system that Bernie was prepared to go. Bernie wanted and this is his word, a revolution was that no one got hurt, no friendships were broken, and that at the end of the day, at the end of the revolution, the masses and the 1% could join hands and sing Kumbaya. you know, and Trump is more realistic.
Yeah.
He understands this is a fight to the death.
Right.
That they are entrenched and interests that run a rigged system, that the Clintons are but a microcosm of the way the ruling class does business. And, you know, it's just the guy who was supposedly or apparently the ideologically more sophisticated, that is Bernie,
right,
turns out not to have as much understanding of the way the system works as does a really kind of crude, self-made businessman as Trump does. So,
yeah. Well, Bernie Sanders hasn't spent most of his life around a real estate closing table either. Let me tell you, there are a lot of lessons to get learned there. When you walk into a room full of people who are all bringing some kind of money, and each one of them is scheming how to walk out with all of it and perhaps some of your flesh, too. You know, there's a way of looking at interaction in politics that grafts right onto rather well in terms of realism.
Yeah, I think you're right. But, you know, Don, the other thing is that money managers, meaning hedge funds and others, are taking their money out of the market and putting it into cash, transforming it to cash out of bonds. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the S&P is showing the most rapid movement of investors from bonds to cash that has occurred since 2008.
Right.
And this has all to do with the election and the uncertainty of what happens after the election.
Right.
Now, this could possibly lead to a politically generated collapse of a stock market.
Yeah.
Now, we're already in a bubble. It's a very fragile situation. You got Yellen talking about eventually in December raising rates, which will have an effect. But a politically motivated stock market collapse, whether it will be a very severe one or a mild one, I think it is almost certain that there will be a downturn in the stock market as a consequence of the political uncertainty that will arise after the election.
You know, if you look at that, I mean, that begs the question, okay, so what would be the policy difference in approaching that collapse between Trump and Clinton? And we already know what Clinton's looks like because that's what we had in 2008. And Trump's is quite different. You know, months ago, I was speaking with Dr. Richard Wolff, and he was talking about, this was the day after or the day of Trump announcing that he was going to find a way using tax policy to repatriate a few trillion dollars of American money that's abroad. And Richard Wolff says, you know, look, that's a pipe dream because once it gets here, there's nothing that can be done with it. There's plenty of money here already, and it's not being invested. It's not being applied to job creation, et cetera. Bringing more here isn't going to solve that problem. And what that leads to is that you, what would have to happen. I mean, Trump saying what he did and saying that there would, that that would be a solution implies to me very strongly, realistically, that he's talking about either nationalizing the big banks or regulating them and requiring them to invest this stuff in a way that would essentially constitute a nationalization, where the government policy would drive investment where it's not productive, which is almost all of it at this point in time. And so, you know, is that one of the models? Is that what Trump has in mind? And more importantly, is that what the elites have in mind and why they're so united against Trump taking office?
You know, that's a very difficult question, and I don't want to impute a level of rationality and progressiveness on matters like that to Trump.
Me neither. But yeah, I will say I will say this. You know, it's been my opinion, we've kicked this around some, that he represents a particular part of capital that right now is getting the short end of the stick. Builders, you know, people that, you know, manufacturers, obviously, with the policies he's talking about, trying, you know, domestic manufacturers, all of that. And they may well want policy to go exactly there. So it doesn't have to necessarily be imputed to him, but perhaps to the people behind him that are inside the power structure.
Yeah. Or... and this is, I think, might be decisive, his base and right. working people in general. If the if Wall Street provokes a, quote, mild recession to bring the politicians to their senses, it might motivate another round of popular protest, Occupy Wall Street on a huge working class basis.
Right.
Working people already primed to dislike Wall Street and the 1%. And they don't need a big excuse to turn their dislike into open hatred.
Yep.
And activism against Wall Street.
Right.
So so that might motivate Trump, let us say, if he is elected or even if he is not elected, to call upon his followers to go after Wall Street, to go after the bankers. And that's not far removed. I think that's on the table for post-election set of actions, which, as you say, you know, references back 4 years ago, 5 years ago, to Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
So, we're back to that, but on a new working class and people's basis.
You know, and there's another echo, too. You might say that what happened in 2008, politically, in September of 2008, when record numbers of people among the American public emailed and mailed and telegraphed and called Washington and said, do not do the bank bailout, which actually forced Congress to vote it down until candidate Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and everyone else went in and twisted the arms of people in the Democratic, the Democratic members of Congress to vote for it, and it was approved. I mean, that may well be, our 1905 with this being 1917, what we saw in terms of that uprising among the population.
I think that's definitely on the table. And, these things... come in threes, war, economic depression or crisis, and popular uprisings and revolutions.
Right.
I mean, they all kind of come in threes like that.
Yeah.
We're a nation that's been at war for 15 years now, nonstop.
Yeah.
And it does not look like there's an end to it. It just looks like things are getting worse with the confrontation with Russia and potentially China.
Yeah.
And a world that is reordering itself into a new situation of alliances against the United States and against the U.S. empire. So it is not far from imagination to apply analogies that go back 100 years ago
right.
to what's happening now. I would just disagree on the 1905. It looked more like February 1917.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, that's true. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But either analogy could work.
Yeah. And maybe the 1905 analogy actually applies to the resurgence in this 1917 of an Occupy Wall Street type movement, because
right.
you had
right.
in around 1905, I can't remember the exact year, when the first Petrograd Soviet was created, and which was kind of, you know, an event sort of like the creation of Occupy Wall Street in the first People's Assemblies.
That's right. And you know for the listeners that don't know, Soviet is the Russian word for council.
That's right.
Or as they have in Venezuela, Bolivarian circles.
Right.
Or as they have in Cuba, committees for the defense of the revolution.
Right.
But these grassroots popular organizations that then take power into their own hands and governance into their own hands. You know, I can see it very clearly from the standpoint of Philadelphia, on matters like schools, on matters like public safety, on matters such as care for children, and on up the ladder, contesting the powers of the official bodies of governance, such as the city council, the mayor's office, and so on. I see this as very possible as relates to gentrification. And this can spill over into multiple areas of protest, including jobs and other things. So, yes, I think in a situation of ungovernability, of political chaos, that councils of the people, call them what you may, could easily emerge in such a circumstance.
And then finally, looking at the post-Tuesday environment, either Clinton or Trump will be elected, or in any event, we'll be told one or the other was elected, and that'll be that, or not. then we've got our work cut out to do along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do Wednesday as we parse the you know, the environment, and also more immediately, suppose the election looks clearly stolen for Hillary Clinton?
Or suppose, for example, Trump wins the popular vote and she wins
right.
the Electoral College.
Right.
Or suppose, and this is a long shot, that neither
no, it's not.
Gets the requisite number.
Right.
And
the House,
it's
right.
thrown into the House of Representatives.
Right. I think that's a real possibility. I do.
Oh, really? Tell me
yeah.
why you do.
I've been looking at the state-by-state numbers that have been coming out over the last few days. And in the swing states, it's very close and anything's possible, particularly with the variables of Trump voters being highly motivated and Clinton voters being poorly motivated. You know, that could
right.
result in a mix that puts both of them below the necessary vote for, to stay out of the House.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which then creates a constitutional and political crisis, the likes of which we have not seen since 1876. Those are possibilities. But I think on the ground, we have to continue the work of political education and political mobilization. I think paramount is immediately alerting the American public and the working class to the danger of war with Russia. Because if you take the language and rhetoric of the elite and the Clinton campaign, they want to get back at Putin and Russia for what they're perceiving as Russia's involvement in this election. And they're going to try to provoke something, either in the Ukraine, in the Baltic nations, or in Syria, or who knows where else.
Right.
But they're going to do something, and I think they want to do it quickly. So I think the war and peace question will be head and center of at this time.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.